Gary Parrish. It's Thursday, August 15, 2019. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Ion College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss camel fighting and leech black. Matt Norlander is here with me, and if we're being honest, there's not much going on in college basketball right now. Pretty quiet, but we promise you, in the offseason, a new episode every week, so we're here. Norlander, what's up with it?
Well, every week, except I do have a vacation next week, so... Oh, yeah. I don't even know if you're aware of that, but yes, I will be off next week. So barring something extremely drastic, this will be the last podcast for anywhere between 11 and 15 days. But yeah, man, thanks to the listeners real quick here. These are the true dog days of the college basketball offseason. August is way low on interesting stuff, usually for the most part, although we do have some good stuff on the podcast here. And we know we still have a consistent listenership, so thank you so much. We really do appreciate that. And regardless of how much news there is or isn't, with the exception of vacation weeks, we will continue to give you podcasts weekly until we get up to the start of the season, in which case, of course, we'll be going back to three times a week.
Meantime, I'm battling tennis elbow, both elbows.
All right. So I'm sure you've talked about this on your radio show, but I'm going to allow you the floor here to do this. But my question, see, as you say that, what the listeners don't know that I do know is you took a sledgehammer to some stuff on your property in recent weeks, which I know led you to walking around like Frankenstein's monster in Colorado Springs. There was a tightness in your muscles. So the fact that you have double tennis elbow, is it directly related to you going ham on whatever the heck you were breaking up 3 weeks ago, and now you're basically incapacitated?
As stupid as it sounds, it is directly related to that, yes. It's the dumbest thing in the world. So we had an old, like, wooden playground set in our backyard that we got when my oldest son, who is now 16 years old, was, like, you know, maybe 3 years old or something, right? We got it for him, and he played on it, and then it sat there for a while because we didn't have another child for 11 years. And now our little dudes like to play on it because they're little dudes, but it's old now. You know, it's probably 13 years old. It's worn from the weather. The wood was starting to crack. It wasn't unsafe, but it was more wobbly than it should have been. And so we developed a plan, pretty basic plan. We're going to get rid of this playground set and then buy a brand new playground set for our little dudes, and they'll enjoy it the same way our oldest son once enjoyed his. So the first step in this is we got to get rid of the old playground set, right? And I guess you can, like, get a drill and take a bunch of screws out and that kind of stuff. That's the way most, you know, men and probably women would approach this situation. But I don't know how to do any of that. Like, I don't know how to do normal stuff that normal people do. I don't know how to do. If you get a Christmas present that needs to be put together, I'm probably not the guy who's going to be able to put that together. So I recognized that the wood was starting to crack anyway. It seemed pretty flimsy. So I said, you know what? I wonder if I just bought a sledgehammer and I could just, like, you know, the wood's already cracking. I could probably, with a sledgehammer, you know, beat it to death, break it apart, and then we just carry it out to the road for the garbage, and that would be perhaps the easiest way to get this out of our backyard. So I go on Amazon, and I order, like, a 20-pound sledgehammer. It comes in 2 days later, because Amazon's amazing, and I go out to the backyard with my brand-new sledgehammer, and I start swinging it, and I break this thing apart. Incredibly...
You're feeling great, I'm sure.
My plan actually worked unbelievably well. I broke the entire thing apart. We took the smaller pieces of wood and slide and everything else out to the street, and suddenly this playground set that we needed to get rid of, that I was thinking about paying somebody to actually do for me, I did it myself. I did it in an unconventional way, probably not the smartest way, but it got done. I cracked all the wood. I took it out to the street. So it was me and my oldest son doing it together. And so the next day, my arms are sore, like from my elbows down to my wrist. They're sore. Like if you never had done squats and then suddenly you did a bunch of squats, your legs might be sore the next day. So that's what I chalked it up to. Like, well, you know, I'm not really used to swinging a sledgehammer, so I guess I'm just sore from swinging a sledgehammer the same way, you know, you'd be sore from doing squats if you never did squats. So I asked my son, I said, yo, because he also swung the sledgehammer a little bit when I was getting tired. I said, hey, yo, are your arms hurting at all from yesterday? He was like, no. I was like, okay. Well, and then I just sort of chalked that up to, well, he's 16 years old and he's in amazing shape. And it's probably just like, that's the difference. He's 16 and in amazing shape, and I'm 42 and not in amazing
47,
shape.
47, but yeah, continue.
And so I figure, okay, well, then the soreness will just go away. And then like a day passes and nothing. And then 4 days pass and nothing. Oh, 2 weeks pass, nothing. I think this is about where you see me in Colorado Springs. And I'm like, dude, my arms are still hurting. But like, I'm just assuming this will go away at some point. Never goes away. So I do talk about it on radio. And radio doctors diagnosed me with carpal tunnel syndrome. And so I started reading about carpal tunnel syndrome, and it was just like, ice your arms, take Advil, that should go away fairly soon. But I've been doing that for about 2 weeks now. It ain't going away. So I finally go to the doctor yesterday, and they x-ray both of my elbows. And you'll be glad to know, my elbows structurally, doctor said I got great elbows. He was like really impressed with my elbows. He was like, your elbows look great. And no damage in terms of structural the structure of your elbow at all. I was like, that's good news, doc. Thank you. I knew I had unbelievable eyelashes. Didn't know I had unbelievable elbows, but it's good to hear. He said, but you do have a severe case of whatever the proper name is. And he said, but it's more commonly referred to as tennis elbow. I said, I got tennis elbow, severe case in both elbows. He said, yes. I said, okay. And because just independent of anything else, tennis elbow doesn't sound that bad. Like, I've heard of tennis elbow before, and I was like, okay, tennis elbow. Well, tough it up. Like, you'll be fine. So this doctor looks at me, and I said, okay, so what do we do next? And he goes, well, what you're going to need to do is buy this flex bar on Amazon. He shows me on his iPad. He said, buy this. You're going to need to exercise with it, probably 8 to 10 times per day. Just twisting it and turning it and bending it. It'll strengthen the tendons and whatever else. I said, okay, that's easy enough. He said, then you need to buy this arm brace for your left arm and another one for your right arm. Mm. And every night when you're at home or whenever you're, not in need of your arms, you need to have these on and ice your arms, like ice your elbows. I was like, okay. And he said, and this is the part that got me. And then if everything goes well, in like 4 to 6 months, you'll be back to normal activity. I'm like, what? Four to 6 months? Dude, you can recover from an ACL more quickly than you can recover from tennis elbow? Like, I am under doctor's orders not to lift anything, play golf, nothing for at least 4 to 6 months. And that's the best case scenario. What in the world?
Not only that, you ignored this advice and used... Now I know I'll let you off the hook. I saw your guitar smashing video. That's yes. A great opportunity. Not a lot of people get an opportunity to smash a guitar, let alone smash a guitar in front of thousands of people. You did that. Your form, the way you came down, it was probably a C at best. You look like a novice. But now that I know that you're dealing with a little double tennis elbow, I'll forgive you for that. The only question I have about that was that a fully intact guitar, or was that propped up for you, ready to be, smashed as soon as it made contact?
Fully intact guitar. Okay. It was at the Memphis 901 FC soccer match on Saturday against North Carolina FC. They've started a deal. It's an expansion team. This is the first year they've ever played. And one of the gimmicks they came up with, to get people involved and people excited, is there will be a pre-match guitar smash, sort of paying tribute to the history of Memphis music. So Penny Hardaway has smashed a guitar. Memphis football coach Mike Norvell has smashed a guitar. Ja Morant, the second pick 2019 NBA draft, has pre-match smashed a guitar. So they asked me if I wanted to smash a guitar, and I don't know how to turn that down. Of course I want to smash a guitar. Now, it's when they asked me and I agreed to do it, it was before I injured both elbows, but breaking up a playground set in my backyard with a sledgehammer. So I committed to it. I was fully healthy. By the time I get to it, I got tennis elbow both elbows. But it wasn't that I was trying to be weak with the guitar smash, the initial swing. It's that I did a lot of how people you watch film, you put in work in the film room. I put in work in the film room, and the film room is basically my office with YouTube. And I went and watched people smash guitars. I was trying to come up with the best approach to make sure this thing actually smashed for a swing. And what I figured out is the key is hit the back of the guitar on the corner of the amp. So the corner of the amp you know, goes through the back of the guitar, and now you've got a smashed guitar. So my initial swing, I was more going for perfect contact as opposed to force. And so that's what you saw. But then my second swing, violent, shattered to complete pieces. Then I guitar pitch. Then I flexed on them hoes. I am told by the Bluff City Mafia, which is the cheering, like the, you know, the group of soccer fans that go really bananas, entire 90 minutes of a match. I'm told that I'm in the top two of guitar smashers so far this season. So far ever. It's a former Tennessee football star, NFL defensive back, Andre Lott, and me. We're the top two guitar smashers so far in Memphis 901 FC history.
Well, congrats on that. It's been it's been an eventful past few weeks here. This is completely overshadows a 70-foot tree falling on my property, but we're 11 minutes into a college basketball podcast. Haven't touched on the college hoops yet, so I'll bypass that story altogether. I've been having unanticipated fun with a chainsaw, all limbs and appendages still in place there. But regardless, yeah, things on the home front have been rather interesting. College basketball-wise, GP, there have been a few interesting stories here. I'll let you take first smack at what you want to get into. Obviously, you've been writing about stuff. I've been writing about stuff. So what shall we lead off with here?
Let's start with the news from last night. Last night being Wednesday night. Michael Avenatti's legal team. Michael Avenatti, of course, being a prominent lawyer, most famously representing Stormy Daniels, who claims to have had sex with the president of the United States. Michael Avenatti's legal team filed a motion yesterday to have extortion charges against him dropped. And it's a motion that brought Zion Williamson, Romeo Langford, and some other high-profile basketball players back into the headlines. For folks who might have missed that story while they were watching the Mets lose to the Braves, Norlander, please provide the details.
Sure. You might have been one of those folks watching the Mets lose to the Braves. That's just a guess, though. All right. There's a lot here, and this is kind of a convoluted story. Let me have a couple minutes to lay this all out because, you know, credit to the Yahoo guys, Dan Wetzel, Pete Thamel, Pat 40, they had this story go up late Wednesday. This particular motion on behalf of Michael Avenatti's legal team was filed in court late on Wednesday. So, okay. Back in March, Michael Avenatti tweeted, in the midst of the tournament, by the way, I don't even think we wound up talking about this on a podcast, period, because it kind of went nowhere and we didn't know like how valid it was, plus, you know, the tournament. So he tweets that he's going to have a press conference the following day that would expose Nike for a lot of high school and college basketball corruption. Okay. When he, first of all, the fact that he is tweeting this, it is bizarre as anything for the aforementioned feuding. He's a foil to Donald Trump, whatever. So Avenatti's like getting involved in this. It's like, what are we even doing here? Within like 30 minutes of that tweet going out, he is arrested and charged with extortion for up to $25 million against Nike. So it was one of those things where for a hot minute there, it was like, whoa, Michael Avenatti might have some stuff on Nike and it might have been doing the same stuff that Adidas wound up in federal court for. Then he gets charged, and it kind of goes away. Like 10 days later, he tweets twice about Nike paying the mother of Zion Williamson, and it kind of is out there, but it just kind of dissipates. Well, on Wednesday night, this becomes a story again because his legal team files a motion to have those extortion charges dismissed from him and dropped altogether. The reason why they want them dismissed is because Avenatti claims, if you really look at the timeline of events that happened here, I was not trying to extort Nike, but in fact, I had linked up with a former Nike EYBL youth basketball coach who had been complaining behind the scenes for a long time about wanting to clean up Nike, which he alleges was just as dirty as what Adidas had to go to federal court for. The company was slow to respond. He was going to present litigation, and then I linked up with the lawyer of this other Nike EYBL coach. The federal government sees it the other way. Michael Avenatti is facing multiple extortion, fraud, tax evasion charges in multiple states, facing decades worth of imprisonment if found guilty. He's got a lot going on. Relatively speaking, this is a high profile kind of story, but in terms of what should mean the most to him, this should be way, way, way down the list. But it's college basketball, it's high school basketball, it's Nike. It is a legitimate story in circles right now. So where do we get to next? Well, in this particular complaint where he is saying, here's why you should not be charging me with extortion, he provides a lot of background, and that background brings some serious allegations and accusations against Nike and former college basketball players who at the time were in high school. So, most specifically, the allegations are that Nike's high-ranking employees, the people that help put on the Peach Jam, run the EYBL circuit, they were knowingly complicit in paying players, families, and or guardians and representatives to entice them to play on the Nike EYBL. There is an allegation that 38 out of 40, and this is per the word, allegedly, of Carlton DeBose, who's one of the highest-ranking Nike employees. He tells a Nike VP, 38 out of 40 Nike EYBL player teams could have been funded with the intention of paying some players, families, representatives on that team. Obviously, these are unfounded. There's actually nothing, GP, in Avenatti's complaint that provides actual evidence, but there are allegations. Let's get to the big names here. Arizona's DeAndre Ayton. Yes, he's back in this. Oregon's Bol Bol. Former UNLV forward Brandon McCoy. Duke's Zion Williamson. Indiana's Romeo Langford. And an unlisted kid from Michigan. We'll get to that in just a second for practical purposes. The allegation is that Nike helped afford a $30,000 payment to DeAndre Ayton's handler, Mel McDonald. There was also $10,000 given to Ayton's mother and travel expenses afforded to Ayton's family in 2016. This would have been long before we knew about the FBI's investigation into college basketball. Keep that in mind. Also, allegations that a $10,000 check was sent to Brandon McCoy's handler, Sean Manning, and $5,000 in cash was delivered to Manning as well. And then in 2017, prior to the FBI investigation becoming public, allegations that a $29,528 wire transfer, that is quite the specific number, was sent to Bol Bol's handler, who was also allegedly DeAndre Ayton's handler, Mel McDonald, and there was a separate $12,500 wire transfer. So, all of this is coming about, and I'll get to the Zion Romeo stuff in just a second here. And it is a convoluted story, but it's just because Avenatti's facing all these charges doesn't necessarily mean that all this stuff is not without merit. Some of it might be true, some of it might not be. This is all happening because a former coach of California Supreme, which was on the Nike circuit, Gary Franklin, he got basically fed up with being pressured to mask payments, put phony invoices, which some of was the exact stuff Adidas got hit for, GP, in the federal trials. He got fed up with that. So he went to Nike and said, I'm not cool with some of your power players on the Nike EYB arm of your company telling me that I have to do this, that if I don't do this, we're going to potentially lose a big-time player like a Bol Bol to the Adidas circuit. So he makes a big stink about it. He's asking Nike to purge itself. And it doesn't really go anywhere. He's wanting justice more than he's wanting money. But, of course, eventually he wants damages. He's losing his own program. This happened in 2017. So Gary Franklin is at the crux of why this is even a thing to begin with. Now, the other allegation therein is that Avenatti claims to have documentation of Carlton DeVos, and you've got Jamal James, another Nike employee, texting Nike recruiting coordinator John Stovall in February of 2017 asking if they would be, quote, willing to do ellipsis, whatever may be needed for the Zion Romeo situations, as well as the money we're now going to do for the redacted kid in Michigan. Now, this creates a lot of headlines and controversy, but we have to be fair to the situation. NCAA rules allow for the parents of prospects to run a grassroots operation if, in the eyes of the NCAA, and then theoretically in the eyes of the shoe companies, it's all on the up and up. That's exactly what happened with Marvin Bagley Jr. when he coached a Nike-funded team for his son, Marvin Bagley III. And guess what? It's also what happened with Zion Williamson's stepfather on the Adidas circuit and Romeo Langford's father on the Adidas circuit. So there remains a possibility that Zion and Romeo's situations as they pertain to Nike might have simply just been a competitive market thing, i.e. why these kids should be getting paid anyway, and the whole notion of amateurism is so deeply flawed. Regardless, fans of opposing programs might want to, you know, jump on this and say, ha, see, we told you. Well, that might be the case, but it also might be the case that Nike was trying to do the same thing with Zion Williamson and Romeo Langford that it was doing with Marvin Bagley III's father. That's entirely possible. And then, if we're being practical about this, the redacted kid, the kid in Michigan,
is the Monty Bates,
right? It can be no one but Imani Bates. At this point, Imani Bates is like in seventh grade. And I did a story on Imani Bates, talked to his father on the record in July. They have invested. The team that is playing, that Imani Bates plays for, is Bates Fundamentals. It is not a team you see year after year after year at the Peach Jam on the Nike EYBL circuit. Nike legitimately has paid the Bates family to become part of that circuit. So while some of this stuff is certainly floating into the realm, if not outright flagrantly violating NCAA rules, Parrish, the Zion, Romeo, and what we will, for official purposes, just assume on our own behalfs is Imani Bates could very well be above board. But it's more of the allegations that multiple teams are being afforded money, paid money, and you have a coach who's in this, who was in the middle of all this, saying that all this NCAA rule breaking was happening. Last thing, I know I've been rambling here, but I'm trying to lay this out as clearly as I can for listeners, because it's kind of an interesting case, and I don't know how far it's going to go along, what this will mean for NCAA investigators. But if I'm a Kentucky compliance director today, I'm having the whole staff in, because there's also a nugget in there that says Nike executives were in communication with the Kentucky assistant. Not that Kentucky was doing anything wrong, but that it had communicated that at least 10 programs on the Nike EYB circuit were being, you know, nefariously funded or funded, you know, through means that wouldn't want to be known publicly. And, you know, a Kentucky assistant merely had this information. You're allowed to have the information. It's not illegal or anything against Kentucky, but it's another reason why we see how pervasive all of this stuff was. And during those federal trials in New York, Adidas and the defense lawyers were saying Adidas was not bidding against itself here. The stuff that we are on trial for obviously was happening at other major shoe companies. This Avenatti case is shedding a light on that. We just don't know what steps might come next and if these charges will be dropped or if they won't.
So I'm not going to make statements here. I want to ask you questions.
Okay.
And you help fill everybody in. First and foremost, I will make this statement. I know some people roll their eyes at Michael Avenatti, and he's obviously got his own legal issues. And because of that, some people insist credibility issues. Let the record show, I believe all this. Do you believe all this?
I believe much of it. I don't know if I would say I would believe all of what's here, but I agree with you that just because Michael Avenatti might prove to be a fraud in many realms doesn't mean that the information that he has here, which his legal team says he has documentation and is asking for discovery for, isn't valid.
Right. Okay. So let me ask you this. Is the obvious difference, first off, let me also say this. I believe, yes, Nike was doing everything that Adidas got in trouble for doing. And also, Under Armour, I believe, doing everything that Adidas got in trouble for doing. But is the obvious difference here between what actually Adidas got in trouble for doing, which is paying Brian Bowen to go to Louisville, paying Silvio D'Souza, a guardian, you know, to ensure, and I know people at Kansas dispute this, but
right,
somebody connected to Silvio D'Souza was compensated by an Adidas official, and then he enrolled at an Adidas school. Like, that's factual. Is the obvious difference here that Nike was funding people to play for Nike teams, and Adidas was actually accused of paying people connected to players in a way that theoretically made them ineligible, and then pushing them to Adidas schools? Is that the difference here?
That's a pretty big fundamental difference. I'll note that Michael Avenatti on Twitter in the past, 14 hours since the story published and since we're doing this podcast, has also reiterated that Nike paid Duke and insinuated that Nike paid Williamson and insinuated that that payment was in an effort to steer him toward Duke. That's a pretty big insinuation there. But a lot of the stuff at the heart of the Adidas trials and the federal trials that tied in Adidas, particularly the first one more than the second one, was more steering the players toward universities or bribing them, and in doing so, putting the universities in danger, i.e. defrauding them. That is not as much of what's depicted here. I'll also say that there's plenty that's not in this complaint, because the complaint, again, is not to get the players or the schools. The complaint is Avenatti saying, I was not trying to extort Nike, and here's the timeline that proves why, because you had a youth basketball coach that for 2 years was trying to clean up Nike from the inside out privately. The company wasn't responding in time, and eventually he went to a lawyer. The lawyer found me. So this is why, you know, yada, yada. That's why this is happening. And only within that complaint, he provides context of what happens. That's why we have all of this stuff. Again, there is no proof of any payments actually happening. There's just strong allegations therein. And if you follow the space, obviously a lot of those allegations are believable.
Listen, I don't think it's an accident that Marvin Bagley has a, or a coincidence that Marvin Bagley's father is, you know, basically given a budget from Nike to start a team that they'll put on the EYBL circuit. And the team, by the way, you and I saw them a lot. They were terrible. Mm-hmm. It was like Marvin Bagley and a bunch of, like, whatevers. They were awful. But they wanted Marvin Bagley to be a part of the EYBL circuit, so you do what you have to do. And then he ends up enrolling at Duke, you know, which is right there with Kentucky as the most prominent Nike school in college basketball. I don't think any of that's an accident. I also don't believe that it's anything new. This stuff has been going on forever. Like, I have a good friend, Keith Easterwood, who ran the grassroots scene in Memphis a long time ago for many years. He was basically Sonny Vaccaro's, you know, guy in Memphis. And he'll tell you stories about deals they had to do just to get players to go to ABCD camp. He'll go all the way back to the time he had to deliver whatever to Ron Mercer's people. And Ron Mercer was the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Like, it was back, you know, to your point about building teams around players. Zion had one built around him. Romeo had one built around him. Marvin Bagley had one built around him. Imani Bates right now has one built around him. Adidas came in here nearly 15 years ago and did a Memphis pump and run team built around Thaddeus Young. You know who ran, coached the team? Felton Young, Thaddeus's father. And then as soon as Thaddeus was off to Georgia Tech, that team just disappeared. It was very much you know, exactly what Nike did with Marvin Bagley. Like, you have a team while this player's here, and then when that player's gone, that team no longer exists. And so I think this maybe pulls the curtain back for casual basketball fans about, oh, wow, you know, these elite prospects, you know, shoe companies will build entire teams around them and take care of their father or mother or guardian or whomever at a pretty elaborate rate. But I think those of us around the sport have always understood this is the way it goes down. And the NCAA has never showed any willingness to try to cut down on it, which frankly has always been surprising to me. Like, the NCAA, except for the NCAA is like in bed with the shoe companies.
Right.
Right. So, like, you don't want to, you know, bite the hand that feeds you, so to speak. But the idea that the NCAA will come down on you if you have a AAU coach pay your mom's car note once, but it's okay if Nike wants to give your father $50,000 to coach a team. That's always been bananas to me, and yet it's always been a real thing that the NCAA has never done anything about.
Right, because it's a thorny situation. This is why the NCAA twists itself into knots so often, because if you just happen to have a really, really, really talented 16-year-old whose father has credentials to coach, why should you not have that opportunity to do so, particularly before you get to the NCAA level when he's in college? So it's why we have so many problems with amateurism and why it, you know, it gets thorny year after year. Now, as we talk about what the NCAA will or won't do, if you've been listening to this pod, you know, hearing the details of this, you know, DeAndre Ayton, $30,000 payment to his handler, $10,000 to his mother, Brandon McCoy, $10,000 check to his handler, Bol Bol, a $29,528 wire transfer. What will the NCAA do? Well, maybe ultimately nothing, because so far as we can tell from the information and just allegations that we have at hand here, these are not involving schools or Division I coaches or assistant coaches. This is purely, allegedly, Nike affecting the the recruitment of players to play on the Nike circuit. And yes, get them under their umbrella, but it's got nothing to do with the schools in particular here, to kind of, you know, circle back and put a bow on what GP asked me at the top of this conversation. So this is an interesting story with interesting details that I have no idea how far it will or will not go. But my prediction right now is, if we get nothing else, I'm 100% on this. Like, the NCAA is not going to do anything to Arizona because of this, because UNLV because of this, Oregon because of this, Duke or Indiana because of this, because it's all strictly confined within the youth basketball grassroots scene based on this information alone. Now, if the NCAA uses this information and then is able to uncover other things, or if it already had this, then, yeah, those schools might be affected. But with what we have here, good talking point, NCAA legislation being doled out, not so much.
Yeah, my prediction would be that, you know, some of these schools that are roped into this story will ultimately be in some sort of NCAA trouble, but I'd be surprised if it's over any of this specific stuff, but we'll see. By the way, it's August 15th. I bring that up because, you know, several weeks ago, it might be months at this point, an NCAA official was quoted on the record as saying multiple high-profile programs would get notices of allegations from the NCAA in the month of July, and that I think the number was maybe six would get them by the end of the summer. And to date, we only know about one. Does that surprise you at all?
Yeah, the only one we know about is NC State. It does surprise me. I thought by August 15th we'd have at least two. maybe we're shaking the cosmic curtains here, and something will come out within the next 24 hours of us doing this. But I'm expecting another one pretty soon here, Parrish. Like, soon. Like, if it happens next week and it's a big program, like, we might have to shake up an emergency pod or something like that. But, yeah, I do expect more. And, you know, when we were on the road in Colorado Springs at the end of the last month, you know, just kind of informally on background, not for attribution, talking to a few coaches, there is an expectation that there will be a wave here, two, three, four programs in the coming X amount of weeks here, but no one has a real strong feel on when it is. There also remains the possibility that such notice of allegation has already been sent out, but whereas NC State, and we lauded them for this rightfully so, release this voluntarily, if another school or two has this at this point, is just withholding it. And if, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests have been sent in, we don't have that yet. I will say I've reached out to a couple of schools that would be on the hook here soon, and was told without, you know, not for attribution, was told just at this point nothing. There's nothing. If it's there, like, you know, those people that would know such things are completely unaware. So yes, I am surprised we don't have more. I would be shocked if we don't have something by the end of August. And if we don't, you know, given that an NCAA high-ranking NCAA official was already on the record about this happening this time frame, I think an explanation is owed if we get to another week or two and we still don't have anything.
It is still the question I get asked most by coaches. Like, we're doing our Candid Coaches series. We're launching it next week. So we've spent the past couple of weeks reaching out to coaches and asking them a series of questions that, you know, for which we'll compile the answers and then present the results. And, you know, I go through the questions, and then at some point, I'd say at least every other coach says, all right, well, let me ask you a question. What's going to happen to these guys? When is something going to happen, and what is going to happen? So it is still a major talking point in the coaching profession, and perhaps we'll have answers, more answers soon. So earlier this week, Norlander, you did a piece on KenPom's ranking of every Division I program, 1 to 353, you actually, rather than just write about it, you went and talked to him and got an explanation for the method. And I thought that was interesting because I believe most people, I guess I shouldn't speak for most people, but my assumption just by looking at the rankings was it was based on results. And it was just the data thrown into the computer, and this is what it spits out. Now, in the KenPom era, Duke is the best program in America. That made sense to me. Kentucky, number two, that made sense to me. But what you found out is that it's not strictly a results-based ranking. What did you learn from talking to Ken about his rankings?
That's a great question, GP. I'm going to give you the answer after the break.
Woo! Are you looking for a new basketball shoe? If so, this is Gary Parrish here to tell you that the New Balance 2-Way V4 features the groundbreaking use of fuel cell technology with fresh foam, creating the ultimate combination of rebound and cushioning. Every step feels explosive and dynamic, and the upper construction features a lightweight textile that's supportive and breathable. So whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the 2-Way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the 2-Way at newbalance.com.
The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me, taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
All right, so I love this from Pomeroy. And full disclosure, sometimes GP and I, and I prefer to do the podcast this way, sometimes GP and I go into a podcast and I don't quite know what we're going to talk about, and I like that because it keeps it fresh. So I didn't know if we were going to talk about the Pomeroy rankings. I was hoping that we would, and indeed we are. It is a fascinating list because it isn't just results-oriented. Shouts to Ken, by the way, who was on vacation, took the call on vacation overseas. I will not disclose your location, Ken, but help get that story done and turned around in time. It's conference affiliation, how you've recruited top 100 prospects in essentially the past decade or so, on top of on-court performance with an emphasis on recency bias. So let me just repeat that if some people are trying to get a hold of it. It's the past 23 seasons worth of data, with an emphasis on recency bias in like the past, I would say 3 to 7 years. That's my own estimation based on what Ken has here. What conference you're in has a role in where you land. And if you've been able to recruit top 100 prospects, the rate at which you were able to recruit those is also playing a huge factor in this. There were a number of schools that stuck out to me. I tweeted about it. There's a story about it if you want to get into that. I'd actually perish. I mean, I have thoughts on some of them, obviously. But GP, if I can just swing this back at you, when you looked at this, I assume like me, like, you know, you thought, okay, this is a great idea. But when either right before you clicked or when you clicked, like, were there a few schools to you that stood out for good or for bad, higher or lower than you expected? Because I actually think the list is fairly good. But then there are inevitably some schools that make you think, well, that seems weird, and I had a number of those that I'll get to in a minute, but I wanted to get your thoughts on what might have stuck out most to you.
I don't have the list right in front of me, but like I said, I wasn't surprised at the top, right? I would assume Duke would be number one and Kentucky would be number two in some order.
Yeah.
It's why it's hilarious to me, and I tweeted this when Ken's rankings came out. Every time I tweet a link to the top 25 and one, you know, it's got right now Duke number two behind Michigan State. Inevitably, I will get people talking about Duke's overrated. Oh, you're overrating Duke again. Dude, Duke is always awesome. Do you realize in the KenPom era, which goes back to 1997, the worst they've ever finished is 19th?
It's insane, actually.
It's insane. Like, with all of the roster turnover, and I know they get all the McDonald's, all the I got it. But the idea that whether it's injury-induced or you're just too heavily reliant on freshmen or somebody's a disappointment, like, all of these things that could, you know, take a season that was supposed to be promising and just push it the other way, it's never happened to them, really. Again, they've never finished outside of the top 20, going back to basically the mid-90s. And so, like, it's almost impossible to overrate Duke.
Right.
Like I tweeted a link to the top 25 and one yesterday, and somebody tweeted back at me, overrating Duke again. And what that implies is that Duke was overrated last year, except Duke was the number one overall seed in the NCAA tournament. If anything, Duke was underrated last preseason if you had them second or third or fourth or fifth. So I wasn't surprised by the top. Duke and Kentucky. One school that you highlighted, because I think you did 13 schools that were interesting to you, was Arkansas. And to me, that's a fascinating deal that speaks to how mediocre and just disappointing that program's been much of my adult life. Because I think you and I agree, and you wrote about this, because we got into this conversation.
Pete Chan.
at Peach Jam with, we had a, you know, some just people from all angles of the basketball community, other writers, but, you know, just all sorts of people. And like, we pretty much all agree, no matter if you think highly of Arkansas or you don't think much of Arkansas, we kind of all agree it's probably a top 25 program in America. And yet in KenPom's rankings, it's 55th. And so it just, the ranking doesn't mesh with the perception, but it is clearly a result on some level. And this to me is one of the most amazing facts about any basketball program in the country. They have not been to a Sweet 16 since 1996. That is it's not impossible because it's true, but my God, it's about as close to impossible as anything could be for that program with all of its resources and all of the success it had in the early 90s to not have been back to the Sweet 16 since 1996. Like, they went to three Final Fours in 1990, 94, 95. So 90, 91, 92, 93, 94. In a six-year period, they went to three Final Fours. In 94, they won the championship. 95, they were the runner-up, played the title game, lose to UCLA. 96, go to the Sweet 16. Imagine if then I'd have said, hey, in this seven-year period from 1990 to 1996, this program has been to three Final Fours, won a national championship, played in two national championship games, and been to a Sweet 16 in 96. And it will never, we'll be talking in 2019, they will not have been back to the Sweet 16. That's crazy.
It's wild and unfortunate for Arkansas in that just the data, and Ken explained it. He said, listen, I have reliable, consistent sport-ranging data going from 1996-97 up until now. Before that, it's just not there. Because I heard from Kentucky fans who were like, why does it cut off right before arguably the best team of the past 30 years? Which that Kentucky team might be my favorite college basketball team of all time. If it was in there, maybe Kentucky has won. But you know what? Maybe not. For Arkansas, though, man, like, we went through every power conference. And the most dismissive view of Arkansas is that it's like 25th or 26th best in America. Just in terms of the job, not the program. And what Ken did with these rankings is he tried to help both media and fans alike just understand the echelon of jobs here so that if you're an Iowa fan who thinks that Iowa's a top 30 job, well, it's really not. Like, it's 42nd here, and that's probably about where it should be, no offense to Iowa. Although Iowa will have an issue with it because Iowa State is ranked ahead of it. And in that state, Iowa is a much, much bigger deal than Iowa State. And just from a pure job perspective, people within the industry would tell you that Iowa is a better job than Iowa State, even though Iowa State's fan base is tremendous. So the Arkansas issue is one where, and I talked to Ken about this, I said, listen, there are some instances here where the on-court performance just is not reflective of how the jobs are viewed in within the industry. Like Arkansas, there is no shot. It's considered outside the top 30, let alone 55th overall. So those performances, you know, over the span of two plus decades that have led to aberrational placements in the rankings, I found fascinating. Like, for example, another team I highlighted was Florida State, 27th, abnormally high. It's the only school rated in the top 30 that has not been in the NCAA tournament at least 10 times in the past 23 seasons. But because it's an ACC school, because Leonard Hamilton has brought in top 20 programs seven times in recent years, and because as of late Florida State has happened to be a good program, it cracks into the top 30. Pomeroy even indicated, he's like, once Hamilton leaves, how good of a program will this be? That's accurate, but you can also say that of a lot of schools. And though college basketball has been around for 80-plus years, I think with a lot of these programs, it can come down to who the coach is. It's incredible that Gonzaga is 12th on this list. It's not surprising. It just speaks to what Mark Few has been able to do. And just, oh, by the way, the Mark Few era almost exactly coincides with the data set we have here from Pomeroy's rankings. Gonzaga is undoubtedly a top 12 program over the past 23 years. The results bear that out, and with Mark Few, that's true. Now, when Mark Few eventually leaves, if Gonzaga drifts back from 12 to, say, 33rd, that wouldn't exactly be the biggest surprise. It's why Virginia being at 17 might seem low to some. I actually thought it was a little bit high because until like three, 4 years ago, Virginia was not viewed anywhere close to what it's been. Tony Bennett has done a tremendous job at that. And in fact, Virginia's ranking, Parrish, I noted this in the piece, it's 17th, but its median ranking, its average ranking at KenPom over that same 23-year span is 51st in his rankings. That's the greatest disparity between where the average is and where it landed in his program rankings of any team in the top 88 overall. I found that kind of fascinating. And yes, let me just get to UConn here real quick because I was surprised. I guessed, before I clicked on it, I guessed and I thought UConn would be 8th in these rankings. They're 19th overall despite having more national championships in the past 23 seasons than any other program. They've been to the tournament 14 times, but Pomeroy said tournament performance was not a factor in this. What you do over the course of a season is. So inherently, if you win a tournament, yes, you're going to beat 2, 3, 4, 5 really good programs and bump up through the rankings. But he said UConn's the only school that busts this thing. And they're also the 2 lowest national champions ever in a given season. The 14 team was 15th overall. The 11 title team was number 10. Those are the lowest ranked champions in the history of his database there. That has played a factor. He also said being in the American has cost them 2 or 3 spots overall. But when you've got, you know, the likes of, say, Indiana without a national championship in that span, ahead of UConn, Wisconsin as well, Gonzaga, of course, I mentioned, even Texas at 10, which it's a top 10 job, I think. I think everyone in the industry would agree with it. I just I found it pretty fascinating. And then Memphis Tigers, just real quick, they're 22nd. I thought that was about right. They had some real dominance there, and they're overcoming being in COSA when it was good and then kind of drifted, and then the Americans can been kind of hit or miss. I cannot recommend these rankings enough. They're just a great way to kill an hour if you're a diehard college basketball fan and kind of want to sort through this in the middle of the offseason.
You can find the rankings, of course, at KenPom.com. If you don't have a subscription, you should have a subscription. And Norlander Story is at CBSSports.com and on both of our Twitter feeds. Before we get out of here real quick, should make note because we talked a lot about it on the previous podcast. Rest in peace to the so-called Rich Paul rule. The NCAA, I believe it was on Monday, announced that they have amended their agent certification process for players testing the waters of the NBA draft. It was a controversial announcement the week prior because, among other things, they would not allow an agent without a bachelor's degree to represent players testing the water. Then LeBron James labeled it the Rich Paul rule because Rich Paul, his agent, doesn't have a bachelor's degree, did not finish college. Rich Paul wrote an op-ed for The Athletic, I think on Monday morning, and 6 hours later, the NCAA announced that that is no longer a stipulation. If you are certified certified by and in good standing with the NBPA, you will be allowed to represent the players testing the process. And I guess I would just say, you know, it's just another. First off, let me give the NCAA credit. They did the right thing. They made a mistake. They publicly acknowledged a mistake. They listened to the criticism, and they adjusted pretty quickly. Like, that's all good stuff. But should have never made the mistake. Should have never had the rule, because it was a rule rooted in, I don't know, nonsense, but also filled with racial overtones. I mean, it felt like it was a rule. Certainly, at least some people interpreted it this way, a rule designed to prevent the young black hustler from getting in the game. It was trying to put up a fence against, as you and many others have pointed out, Christian Dawkins-like characters as opposed to Rich Paul. This would have, as Rich Paul noted in his op-ed, would have had no impact on him. He's bigger than this. Either way, the point I made in my column is that this is a rule that was in place because of a recommendation from the Commission on College Basketball, and it's just the latest example of the Commission on College Basketball making a recommendation that's just going to be rubber stamped by the NCAA, that people around the sport who have a good grasp for the inner workings of the sport identify very quickly as just, that's a bad recommendation. And yet they keep making bad recommendations. And so the point I made is, like, the next mistake the NCAA needs to admit is that it is a poorly constructed commission on college basketball. They have a lot of successful, brilliant, and I say this sincerely, people on that committee. But they do not understand the inner workings of college basketball. They're not equipped to do the job the NCAA has asked them to do, and I don't know how much more time we need to take to acknowledge that Condoleezza Rice is an impressive, impressive human with an incredible Wikipedia page filled with accomplishments, but she should not be the face of a committee that is trying to overhaul amateur basketball because she simply doesn't, she's not familiar enough with the inner workings of amateur basketball.
Yeah. Your column was broadly correct. I don't see how the NCAA is going to walk this stuff back. They made too much of a public spectacle of it. This will be in the first paragraph of Mark Emmert's legacy, if you will, of his time at the NCAA. This is, you know, by his own doing and what people will view it as. And it, I mean, they are viewing it as I think, a success, and many others are viewing it as a misguided shortcoming there. The rule getting amended is great. My big takeaway was, one, I thought way too much of was made of this whole thing in general. But that's what's going to happen if LeBron James, Chris Paul, and hello from the wings, Kevin Hart, come on down, chiming in on this stuff. Like, when you've got people with a combined, you had it in a previous column, like 90 million Twitter followers. Who knows, like, how many combined on all social media channels? Yeah, obviously, it's going to create a ton of noise. I get all that. But again, in practical purposes, this rule put into place affecting players on an annual basis, I think, will be in the single digits. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be in place if it can negatively affect one player. Like, obviously, you should consider a rule like that. But I thought there was way, way too much noise around this. That said, I like that they amended it. And I want us to keep in mind, the next time there's a high-profile, controversial rule change, the NCAA was able to fix this within a week's time. I think less than a week's time. It's notoriously slow on a lot of stuff, and here it wasn't. Now, I don't know if that's because of where it falls on the legislative calendar or some other stuff that people won't even care about. The NCAA, when it wants to be or when it needs to be, can act fast on things. It needs to be more like this more often. That was what was refreshing about it. Yeah, it was a small change and a relatively minor rule, but it needs to display this kind of stuff way more often. As for the commission, I agree. Unfortunately, with you, Parrish, unfortunately, it's going to take years to drift away from a lot of that stuff because what the commission did and what it recommended, they've had multiple high-ranking officials go on record time after time saying that what that commission recommended, it's going to take seriously a lot of it. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And you've obviously seen that come to play, as we've discussed plenty on this podcast, with the recruiting calendar, tweaks of which I still expect to change in the next coming year.
Yeah, I agree with you. I insist that they should do away with this commission. I do not think that they will, because I don't think they have any interest in embarrassing Condoleezza Rice. I don't think they have any interest in acknowledging that they created this poorly. Again, and it's an impressive list of people independent of anything else, but they don't need those people on that commission. If you're really trying to understand amateur basketball and have thoughtful ideas about how to fix it, you need grassroots people on that commission. You need college basketball coaches who are working right now on that committee. You need recruiting analysts. You need not necessarily me or you, but people like us who have been, in my case, you know, involved at every level of the sport for two decades now. You need people who actually are out there, who understand it, and who recognize what the issues really are and maybe don't have obvious solutions, but at least have ideas that won't be panned every time they're made public. Because the Commission on College Basketball, whether it's the recruiting calendar or this, their recommendations are, in real time, as they're made public, panned. And people explain, this is why this isn't good. And the idea that they don't see that while developing the idea is an obvious problem. For instance, I think you and I, people like us, could maybe serve on a commission of college basketball and be effective. But if you took us and asked us to serve on a commission of amateur hockey, I wouldn't have any idea what to do. I don't know anything about amateur hockey. I'm not immersed in amateur hockey. In other words, I am about as qualified to serve on a commission of amateur hockey as some of these people are who are serving on the Commission of College Basketball. And so, again, incredibly successful people, but not equipped to do the job that they're being asked to do. And that's why we keep getting one very public mistake after another. You ready to get out of here?
Let's get on out of here. Get those arms feeling better. I got to get back to the chainsaw at some point today. Take care of more of that 70-foot willow tree that fell down in my backyard. But, GP, it's always great to catch up with you. Always great to hear from you. I need you feeling fresh and good to go by, say, about Valentine's Day. Can we try and make that happen?
I'm under doctor. I ordered my arm braces and ice packs last night. They should be here Friday. I'll be in the recovery mode ASAP. What a depressing.
That's an
day.
Amazing vision, Paris. I can see it. It's probably not all that different from your usual Saturday and Sunday. You know, in the recliner, Mets game on, a little beverage off to the side. But I have this vision of you like arms at a 45-degree angle, perked up, and just loving life when the Mets are winning, hate it when they're losing, and just like going to the grocery store. So you're at the grocery store, and you can push the cart because that's the angle your arms need to be at, but then right. Like you're almost like a robot. Like you go and grab the carrots or grab the box of cereal, and you can't bend your arms because they're all stuck together.
Well, you can it's actually kind of weird what you can and cannot do. I'm not supposed to pick anything up in the natural way that you would pick something up. So like if there's a shoe on the ground, the way you right now would reach down and pick that up, I'm not supposed to reach down and pick that up. I need to have, anytime I'm picking something up or carrying something, either palms of my hands, facing each other, or palms of my hands facing up. So if I go pick up my backpack now, I need to scoop it up as opposed to just pick it up. You mentioned on the couch, beverage next to me. When I now go, under normal circumstances, I would just reach with my left hand. I've got a table right next to my couch, and I would pick up my drink and have a drink, and I pick it up. Right. I can't do that anymore. That's painful, and it's doing damage to my elbow. So I have to actually turn my whole body, pick up a cup with two hands like I'm a four-year-old, and drink it while I have to hold my cup with both hands. It's so stupid.
It's actually amazing, and I need video.
It's like somebody's telling me, hey, make sure you use two hands when you pick up your drink. I have to use two hands when I pick up my drink. That's the other thing. It's not just one elbow. Most people who get tennis elbow, it's one elbow.
Yeah.
I'm both.
You've got to be over under people in America right now that have double tennis elbow, not related to tennis at all, let alone having double tennis elbow. I'm setting it at like 9.5. I don't think you're alone because a lot of people do a lot of stupid things, but you're in a rare class.
It's unbelievable. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Terry M. F. and Teagle. He's the legend. Shouts to Larnell. And please go subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast via Apple Podcasts. While you're there, rate it 5 stars. Leave a nice and positive comment. We would appreciate it. And either way, we will talk to you again next week. Till then, take care.